Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Friday, July 24th. I'm Taylor Heckert. A new food truck has come to town in Petersburg, and their fare is selling like hotcakes, or should I say, hot waffles. Evan Prusak is the owner of Wander Waffles, and KFSK's Baze Hohen visited him in his truck to see what the waffle hype was all about.
In a bright orange truck at the end of Petersburg's Singley Alley, Evan Prusak is measuring out the last of his waffle batter.
Well, I'm just putting a little grease on the waffle iron before I pour the batter on. And I'm learning the precise amount to not make the waffle too small, but also not to make too much of an overflowing mess.
Prusak is the owner of Wander Waffles, Petersburg's newest food truck. And Prusak's waffles aren't just any old waffles. They're made with sourdough.
Well, I just thought if I'm making waffles in Alaska, it has to be sourdough.
Prusak has been a waffle lover ever since he was a kid.
Whenever mom was feeling unmotivated to make dinner, I would raise my hand and, oh, can I make waffles?
But before he became a waffle chef, Prusak was a traveling pastor. He says the name Wander Waffles was inspired by his once nomadic lifestyle.
So I'd be in an area sharing the gospel and a couple nights at a time here and there moving on.
One of these trips took him to Hong Kong, where street waffles became a staple of his diet.
I had basically no money when I was there, and so I couldn't like eat out a lot, but the street waffle would be like $2 or whatever. So that was like my treat.
That traditional Hong Kong style waffle, topped with a dollop of peanut butter, a drizzle of sweetened condensed milk, and a sprinkle of sesame seeds, stuck with Prusak. When he decided to stop being a pastor last year, Prusak moved to Petersburg and got a job salmon seining. In the meantime, he started developing his own waffle recipe. Prusak debuted his sourdough waffles during Petersburg's Little Norway Festival in May, and it was a great success. He even tried out a new savory waffle recipe with cream cheese and smoked salmon.
Day one, I sold like two of those. But then day two, I sold like 150. It was like people started seeing other people with it, and then it just became a thing.
Since he opened, Prusak has already leveled up his sourdough recipe.
Just a month or so ago, someone here in town gave me their sourdough starter, which is from the Yukon Gold Rush, so it's legit.
Serving waffles in Southeast Alaska is not without challenges. Waffles can't pay all the bills, so Prusak works full-time at a refrigeration company in town. Even with some extra help to run the truck from a few local teens, his workday is still bookended by boiling blueberry sauce at 6 a.m. and batter prepping late at night. Supply chain issues can also add hiccups. Because his recipe uses some of the same ingredients as the Hong Kong street waffles, it can be hard to get them delivered to Alaska.
So I was just buying a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, but I've realized that doesn't really work because you run out of stuff and you can't get it quick enough.
Because of these challenges, Prusak recently made the decision to only run the truck on weekends instead of during the week. But Prusak says he's not in it for the money. He's in it for the relationships. As he's measuring out the last of his batter, a group of kids on bikes ride up to the truck.
Free waffles.
Hoping to try their luck for a free waffle.
Actually, yes, because I have this much left. I'll give you one free waffle.
Yeah. He makes them his most popular item, a waffle slathered in a decadent blueberry sauce and doused with whipped cream.
Thank you.
And he gets rave reviews.
Is it good, you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For Prusak, the best part about serving the Petersburg community is moments like these.
I'm not pretending like this is anything spectacular. It's just a waffle, but it's just a nice treat for people, and I want them to be able to have a pleasant interaction and positive community experience.
And while Prusak stays humble, his waffles remain the talk of the town. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Baze Hohen.
The Alaska Division of Elections has moved thousands of registered voters to its inactive list due to suspicions that they are not citizens. State Director of Elections Carol Beecher acknowledged the allegations may be based on very old data. She told legislators at a hearing in Anchorage Wednesday that her agency sent 3,500 letters to Alaskans saying the Division of Motor Vehicles had flagged them as possible non-citizens. Beecher portrayed this as a routine exercise that doesn't take away anyone's right to vote. She says people who got the letter can just check a box to indicate they are citizens or call or email the division.
We are simply asking individuals to confirm, because we received information from a verified source, that these individuals were not U.S. citizens.
Some of the voters who received the letter went online to check their voter registration, and they were alarmed to find they'd already been removed. Some contacted their legislators, including Representative Andrew Gray, a Democrat from Anchorage, who raised it with Beecher at the hearing. Two legislators said they were concerned the letters might have been part of a federal initiative. President Trump has been trying to assert more influence over the state elections, warning of fraud that election experts say is unfounded. Beecher said this isn't related to the federal government. Every 3 months, she said, the division checks its voter list against the Division of Motor Vehicles data, looking for people who may have said they were not citizens when they got their driver's licenses. This time, she said, the list they got back was unusually long.
So we understand that some of this is probably very old data where the individuals did not contact DMV, have not updated that they are a naturalized citizen. I believe that people probably don't realize that all of these governmental entities don't necessarily talk to each other.
She said voters who don't respond will remain on the inactive list, but she said they can still vote a questioned ballot. While Gray and other legislators sounded uneasy about the letters their constituents got, Republican Representative Kevin McCabe from Big Lake defended the division's actions, saying it's the agency's job to ensure the voter rolls are clean and correct. State lawmakers have ordered their professional, nonpartisan auditors to examine the Alaska Board of Fisheries' procedural actions going back to October 2023. The audit was spurred by concerns about ethics violations, lack of transparency, and failures to follow policymaking procedures defined in state law, state regulators, and the board's own internal policies. Representative Louise Stutes, a Kodiak Republican who has chaired the House Fisheries Committee for the last 8 years, says she's heard from more and more fishery stakeholders across the state.
A common theme that, in the eyes of the public, is growing more severe each year is the board's adherence to a transparent public process, ethical conduct, as well as its own policies, regulations, and statutes.
Stutes requested the audit through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. She spoke to the request in committee last week. She pointed to the May decision by the state's acting attorney general, Corey Mills, to overturn 5 regulations the board passed in February. Those regulations would have reduced commercial salmon fishing in some parts of the South Alaska Peninsula, commonly called Area M. On May 19th, Mills ruled the board's votes were improper and voided the changes. Stutes says that's proof the board is not being ethical or transparent in its decision-making process.
Board decisions are consequential, often impacting thousands or tens of thousands of Alaskans within a single action. It is for these reasons that the board's processes and procedures are, by law, transparent, ethical, and with ample opportunity for public comment.
Proponents of the board's Area M decisions, like the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission, say the regulations would have protected some of those salmon bound for the Yukon River and Western Alaska subsistence fishermen. But opponents say the Board of Fisheries violated state ethics laws when they approved the new regulations. Stutes says she consulted with state auditors and requested they focus not on the outcomes of the board decisions, but the processes leading up to them. For example, whether agenda changes or emergency petitions were accepted and considered based on state laws. The state legislative committee unanimously approved her request. Chris Curtis, the state's legislative auditor, told the committee her staff did a similar review of the Board of Game about 8 years ago, which has similar processes. And, coincidentally, her office recently created a new section focused specifically on audits of this scope.
I believe we'd be able to start this fairly quickly, which is unusual for the Division of Legislative Audit.
Curtis says the audit could be finished by the next legislative session in January. About 400 miles north of Fairbanks, teams of scientists at Tulik Field Station study the Arctic. The station's support staff run things behind the scenes, like cooking meals, fixing what's broken, and keeping everything clean. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, that work doesn't end up in research papers, but it makes those papers possible.
On a sunny, windless day above the Arctic Circle, a ribbon of smoke twists into the uninterrupted sky above. Everybody who works at Tulik has a favorite chore. Sally Anderson's is burning trash.
It's helpful because it gets all of this waste gone, and it's like kind of easy, you know?
It's a little bit therapeutic.
Yeah, sometimes throwing stuff in that you're just like, oh, gosh.
All the waste produced by Tulik's 100 or so seasonal residents has to get trucked out or burned. Anderson's hurling bags of soiled toilet paper into an incinerator the size of a car. Orange flames flicker out of the lid with the impact of each new bag. Like many of her coworkers, Anderson took a winding route to get here. She has a degree in food science.
I was a microbiologist for a bigger chocolate company. Then that was sucking my soul and I hated corporate life. And I was like, I'm leaving like a temperature censored like kitchen area that I taste chocolate every hour, and I'm going to like the tundra to get eaten alive by mosquitoes.
Nested in the foothills of the Brooks Range, Tulik Field Station is one of the world's premier Arctic research stations. It's open year-round, but at the peak of the summer season, about 100 people from universities and research institutions all over the world gather here to study things like plants, animals, and permafrost. But none of that happens without the dozen or so employees who keep the station running. Many of them work year-round, supporting similar research stations in places like Antarctica and Greenland. Jonathan Karkachi is a PhD student at Florida Atlantic University who spent part of the summer here studying tundra flowers. Before digging into a plate of ziti, he says he's better fed at Tulik than he is back home.
You know, like I come here and I get 3 square meals a day. They're all hot. I mean, at home, I'm like lucky if I eat more than a pasta with a little bit of sauce and a can of sardines.
Amanda Thier is one pair of hands behind the food.
I do cook and bake a ton at home, and I always try more increasingly complicated recipes.
Thier says the work days start early, but she usually has time in her schedule to get out and hike around the tundra or bask in the station's sauna. And there's a weird rhythm that comes with working from pole to pole. Some are employed all year, while others have gaps they use to travel, visit family, or do side gigs. Before Fear was feeding scientists, she was an accountant in San Francisco. She got her start on the other side of the planet, at McMurdo Station in Antarctica.
As somebody who has lived in that corporate America zone for a good 5 to 6 years, like, I didn't feel inspired every day. Yeah, I like feeling inspired, and like each day is new and fresh.
Fear says she had the idea to go for years, but right after the peak of the pandemic, her grandfather, dog, and a close friend all died within the span of a couple months.
It was just like a bam, bam, bam. And so I was just like, ooh, I need to just be gone for a bit.
Many Tulik staff described hardships that prompted them to reevaluate their lives and enter this line of work. Manny Prince does a lot of things at the station, helping with search and rescue, fixing things, and kind of filling in wherever he's needed. He says he left behind a warmer, easier life in Texas after he lost both of his parents.
6 years ago, if you would have told me I'd be doing this, I'd think you're insane. But this has probably been one of the coolest turns in my life that I didn't know I needed.
He says over the last year or so, sweeping cuts to science funding have left many in the Arctic research community uncertain about what comes next. But that's made his job keeping scientists safe and housed feel more important than ever.
People need to understand that science is continuing. It's not going anywhere.
And neither are the people making it possible. At Tulik Field Station, I'm Shelby Herbert.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.